Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. ExpressVPN.com/film.
Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust custom 5-in-1 spray paint lets you choose from 5 spray patterns with a twist of the dial. It protects indoor and outdoor metal and wood projects for long-lasting results and is available in more than 40 colors. Get started on your painting project at Menards, number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big money at Menards.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, June 28th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Michael Sarnowski's new movie, A Quiet Place, Day One, and we're also going to present an interview with writer-director Michael Sarnowski. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com. I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
And Slash Film editor, BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
All right, everyone, let's talk a little bit about this movie. We'll kick things off with some non-spoilery thoughts about the film. Chris, I know you reviewed the movie for Slash Film. I have linked to your review in the show notes. I encourage people to read that review there. So because I already know what you thought about the movie, I want to open it up to BJ first. BJ, what did you think about this one?
Oh, man, I loved this movie. full disclosure, did not think I was going to like it. I, in the lead up to this, was like, what, do we need this? Who asked for this? This is just like the Fear the Walking Dead of the Walking Dead. I don't need this for A Quiet Place. Love how wrong I was, because this is not only my favorite movie in the series thus far, but this is right up there as one of my favorite movies of the year so far. Right now, I feel like I've seen like 5 movies that are, you know, duking it out for my favorite that I've seen. This is, it really won me over.
Excellent. Okay, Chris, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm right there with BJ. I don't go into any movie expecting to hate it or wanting to hate it, but I was like, oh, this is the third movie in a series. That's never a good sign. It's a prequel. That's frequently like a studio's lazy way of being like, how can we milk this cash cow for even more? So I just went into it expecting, like, you know, just like a lazy summer blockbuster cashing in on the name. And I got this weirdly soulful, emotional, reflective, meditative movie, like, that occasionally is like, oh, by the way, this is a monster movie. And like, I got the sense that if they could cut the monsters out of it entirely, they honestly would, and just make it a movie about two people wandering around New York City after an apocalyptic event. And those are like the moments that really stuck with me, these for lack of a better word, these quiet moments where Lupita Nyong'o and Joseph Quinn are just wandering around New York and growing closer. And, you know, it almost, you know, I don't think it's as good as the Before trilogy, but it honestly gave me that sort of vibe of these two people bonding as they wander around a city. And that's not what I was expecting at all. I was expecting a kind of generic run-of-the-mill monster movie, and that's not what this is.
Yeah, I was excited about this movie because Michael Sarnowski directed a movie called Pig back in 2021 that I think all three of us loved. It was on Slash Film's top 10, like collective top 10 movies of the year in that year. And it's a really quiet movie that also is kind of surprising in several ways. It's like a revenge film that does not really follow the standard revenge tropes. It's a food movie. It's one of Nicolas Cage's best performances, but it's not him like going full Cage. It's a really quiet, contemplative, very interesting film. So as soon as Michael Sarnowski was signed on to direct this movie, I was immediately interested in it. But there's something about the trailers for this movie, and maybe it was just like the omnipresence of them, where like Paramount was really hammering these trailers, and for what feels like months on end, like every single movie I saw, this trailer was in front of it. And I was like, God, enough already with this. And I just kind of like was worn down by it. But it looks like they knew what they were doing, because apparently, you know, we're recording this on Friday afternoon, and evidently the movie had like a great Thursday night at the box office, seems to be off to a great start. So congrats to everybody involved on that front. It's always good to see movies succeed. And then B, like you guys are saying, like the movie actually ended up to be like a really good thing that I think is not quite what the trailers are selling. There's a huge aspect of this movie that is not in the trailers at all, like a key character thing that completely changes what the movie even is from what you see in that trailer. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. But I think all of us are really surprised at what we saw here.
I'm genuinely interested to see how this goes over with audiences. I saw it with an audience, and my audience really, really liked it. They were like clapping at certain scenes and stuff like that. But as you said, like the marketing is really selling this as like this action movie. And while there are, you know, set piece action scenes, it's really not that at all. I'm very curious to see if people are like, they lied to me or whatever. But, I don't know how a general audience is going to react to this. But based on my audience, they really liked it. Like there's I guess we'll get to spoilers talking about, but there's like a scene near the end where people were like cheering in my audience. I was like, all right, I guess they're on board with what this movie is doing.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it in a press screening, and press screenings are always really interesting because you either have people that are really willing to give themselves over towards a movie, or they are so above it and they're not going to let anyone know how they feel about this movie because that's what the review is for. And it was a pretty active audience. Like the movie got to people, which I really thought was a very, very cool thing. But you're totally right in saying that like a major thing is hidden in the trailers, which I'm not going to spoil now. But what I'm very fascinated is looking at what happened with Abigail, which was a movie that did, you know, mention what one of the big spoilers is in the marketing. And then people were disappointed. They're like, well, I already knew the spoiler, so the first 30 minutes felt like it dragged because I already knew it was going to happen, versus this movie where they hid something that's very important. And there might be people who are going to be disappointed because they were expecting something that is totally different. So like, it's really interesting that in the same year, we got two movies that took very different approaches to marketing. And it kind of looks like A Quiet Place made the right call on this, because no one seems to be mad about it.
yeah, that's true. Okay, so I think we tried to dance around this as much as possible. So let's open things up to spoilers now. If you've not seen the movie and you want to go into it knowing as little as possible, hit pause, go check it out. I think all of us would recommend it, certainly. Okay, so the thing we're talking about is that Lupita Nyong'o's character has cancer, and like that is a
she's in hospice, she's like actively dying.
I was totally shocked. I mean, I totally did not expect that at all. And then like BJ, you talk with Michael Sarnowski about this in your interview that people will hear very shortly, but it completely changes the calculus of the movie, because she's no longer interested in being a standard survivor. So the film automatically just has like this much, much different than you would expect kind of trajectory for it, because the characters are not going on the path that every single other character in a situation like this would be going on. So it makes it like automatically inherently more interesting to watch that way. So I just loved that, storytelling choice. Chris, what did you think about that?
Yeah. You know, when I wrote my review, I was like, really debating whether or not to even mention the character as cancer, because it's not in the marketing, but the movie isn't shy about it. The movie shows you like right away, like right up front, she's in hospice. And I ultimately decided to not put it in the review because it does feel like a spoiler, but it's such a huge detail that I really like grappled with like how to shape the review, because it's like it really determines why that character does what she does, like all her choices. So it's kind of a tricky line to walk, because I didn't want to like ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen the movie yet, but it's just a fascinating way to get you into that character's, you know, mindset and her world. And like, it's not what it's, you know, when you watch movies like this, they're about people who are like fighting to, you know, do everything they have to do to survive. And that's the complete opposite of what this character is. There's like a great shot in this movie where like hundreds of people are walking towards the seaport and they're all going in one direction, and she's walking in the complete opposite direction through them. And I was like, that's such a great like visual cue to, you know, this character's motivations and what she's doing. And I'm very interested again to see how people react to this.
Yeah. I love that shot. I mean, my wife and I were watching this together, and like, as soon as there were, I don't know, four or five people that seemed to be walking in that direction, we were like, ah, people are making too much noise. And then the movie just like keeps piling on, and that group, that crowd keeps getting bigger and bigger, and like everybody's footsteps and all the little wheels squeaking and everything. And
God, just like, guy's like a suitcase. It's like, come on, yes. I think you can leave your suitcase behind, buddy.
So BJ, I know you have like a personal connection to this. I don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot. If you don't want to talk about this.
Oh no, I talk about the fact that I should be dead all the time.
Okay. Yeah. So like, I assume this movie must've hit you, in a way that it didn't hit me and Chris on that front anyway.
Oh, I like thought I was going to hyperventilate in the theater. I was crying so hard because, I mean, I've talked about it before on the show, but for those that don't know, I am a pancreatic cancer survivor, but when I was diagnosed, I was given a 5% chance to live. I was 23 years old and had to make a living will. Like, all statistics point to I should be dead. And the fact that I'm not is a legitimate medical miracle. So I'm very used to what it feels like to think that you're terminal, to, you know, start mourning the end of the world before it's actually the end of the world. And the second she started talking about like, oh my God, I want pizza. Like if I go into the city and I go see this show that you're bringing me to, Alex Wolf, I want pizza. I was like, oh, she knows she's dying. And oh my God, like, because you know, I know the Quiet Place movie is bringing. So I was like, she's gonna be dying. And this is all going to happen on like, what's probably going to be one of her last days. Oh my God, can I make it through this? And by the end of it, I was just weeping because, you know, this is a movie that's not about survival. It's about dying on your own terms, which when you are terminal is such an important thing. Like hospice does as best as it can to, you know, prepare you, to help you, but dying in a place that is not your home, or dying in a place that is sterile and where thousands of other people have died before you, like, doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she is spending this entire movie basically preparing for her death the way that she wants it to be was so much for me to handle. And I was a disaster by the end of it. So between Inside Out 2 and this movie, it's been a great, great experience, me bawling my eyes out at the Grove AMC in Los Angeles. Good God.
Yeah, man, Lupita Nyong'o is so good in this movie, and Joseph Quinn is great too, like totally unrecognizable from his role as Eddie in Stranger Things. Just like, yeah, really.
That hair does a lot of work.
It really
does. I love when actors get to use their actual accents. It's like my favorite thing.
Yeah. I thought this movie was really good. I liked it. I think I still might like the first film a little bit more, but I had a great time here. I was extremely impressed that this is Michael Sarnowski's second feature film. I loved that this was basically a movie who's about somebody who is like understandably closed herself off to the world. And it's about her learning to make a connection again with another person, even in the midst of these apocalyptic circumstances. It's just like such a simple, clean premise for a movie that could have, you know, taken a deep dive into like the lore and mythology of these alien creatures and all this stuff. Like this movie is not interested in that at all, which I really appreciated. So, speaking of the aliens, though, I wanted to ask you guys about this. I did feel a little underwhelmed by the scares in the movie. Like there were a few jump scares that got me, and I loved seeing them all rumble as a group through the city and like those gigantic herds or whatever. But like the actual tension in the movie didn't really live up to what it was in the original film for me. And I wondered if I was the only one that felt that way. Chris, you said, like, you know, if they could have cut out the alien stuff, maybe they would have. But what did you think about, like, the actual, I don't know, the horror component of this, I guess?
Yeah, I don't think it's like a scary movie at all, honestly. But that did not bother me. I feel like if it were like a lesser movie, if like the movie itself wasn't good, like if those non-monster scenes were bad, I'd be like, well, this sucks all around. But I feel like the movie is so good on its own terms that I really didn't miss the monster stuff. Like, honestly, whenever they would have a monster scene, I'd be like, all right, I'm like, this is kind of like distract. I was like, it was like, I'd rather they'd get back to the moments of them just hanging out in New York. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just thought those quiet moments, like where she's like at the bookstore, and that great scene near the end where they're in the jazz club and he's showing her that really stupid magic trick. It's such like a sweet, like those are the things that work so well in the movie. And like, there's like one scene where Lupita Nyong'o has like a dream and there's like a cheap ass jump scare. And I was like, boy, I wish they had cut that out. Like, yeah. That like, it just seems like,
I could smell the studio note of, we need another scare.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, I was just going to say, like, it just seems like the producers are like, you need to throw a scare in here, please. Where are all the scares? And it's like, it genuinely feels like the movie is not interested in that. And it kind of is like Pig again, where Pig, you read the description where it's Nicolas Cage has to get his pig back. And it's like, oh, this is going to be like John Wick with a pig instead of a dog. And the movie is actually not interested in that at all. And that's sort of like, that's his thing, I guess. Michael Sarnowski's thing is where he takes this premise and he's like, I'm going to do the complete opposite of what you're expecting from it. And I'm really good at doing that. Like, thankfully, you know, thankfully he's a good filmmaker and he doesn't like bot, like, because this could have gone wrong in so many ways. And I'm so glad it does not.
Mm-hmm. BJ, do you have any different thoughts about the horror angle here?
I mean, this is, it's an entirely different type of horror movie because of the location. One, those aliens freak me out in general because I don't like things with limbs that are too extended. It's the same reason I don't like the aliens and No One Will Save You, because get them out of here. They're like, the arms are too big. Mm-hmm. And that's very much how I feel about this. But in the first two A Quiet Place movies, for the most part, they're dealing with like a handful of these creatures at most, because they're in a rural area, it's isolated, there's not like an onslaught, it's like there's like three of them that are hanging out in the neighborhood that we need to be worried about. Whereas in this movie, because they're in a major city, they're in like the loudest city in the country, there are like hundreds of these things, so it feels less like an isolated thing to be afraid of and more like it's inevitable. They are there. They are everywhere. And so I think I just get accustomed to their presence, so they don't feel as threatening to me because I know that they're there. So it's a matter of, I care more about watching these characters get through here than whether or not like, oh no, is the monster going to see them? Because the answer is yes, they will. Of course, there's way too many of them. So yeah, the scares are like fine, but I don't care about them. I don't need them. I know that they're there as a vehicle to move the story around because they have to be there. But yeah, the movie for me is not about, and it's, I feel the same way about the first two Quiet Place movies. It's never been about the aliens for me. It's always been about the characters and the family and the connection. And in this instance, like, it is a found family between these two people at the end of the world. Mm-hmm. That is always going to be more interesting to me than blowing shit up.
Yeah,
even though it's blowing shit up's cool, but you know.
Yeah, part of me wonders if it's partially because this is now the third time that we've seen these creatures, and there appears to be only so much you can do, only so much they can do as creatures, really. Like, we kind of know their playbook at this point, and there's not a ton of variation that you can put into them as a storyteller. So I don't know, I guess if I were to ding this movie, I would say that, like, maybe for it to be like a true A+ in my mind, it would be all this great human interaction that exists, but also like some super scary stuff mixed in. And the stuff as it exists now is just kind of like, oh yeah, this is fine. Like Chris was saying, you know, we can skip over this and get back to the human interaction here. But this is a terrific cat movie. I wondered Hell what yeah. you all thought about the cat. What would you think, BJ?
Frodo forever. That cat rules. I know that it's played by two cats, Nico and Schnitzel. Why do I know that? Because I follow them on Instagram now because I'm a lunatic. I love a good animal performance. This is a great animal performance. This cat is so cute, like obscenely cute, but also I love that it's – a service animal. Like, it's canonically a service animal. It's not just a pet. And so many of the decisions that this cat makes are in service of the humans, which I think is incredible. Like, it's such a smart way of incorporating this animal that doesn't feel like a cheap, like, oh, it's a pet in distress, that way the stakes are higher. It's like, no, this animal has a purpose for why this animal's here and why the decisions are being made for what this animal is doing. Yeah, great cat performance. 10 out of 10, I would die for Frodo.
Yeah, Chris, I know you're a big fan of pets on film too. So what'd you think about this cat?
Yeah, great cat. I have a cat. My cat is an asshole and a monster. And like, if I was in this situation, my cat would get me killed so fast. Or like, so I was kind of envious of the, I why can't my cat be like this cat? Like, that's such a good cat. And yeah, just great. And I love every shot of them like cradling the cat. I love when they pull him on the boat at the end and he's got the cat and he's hugging the cat. It's like, yeah. Oh, what a good cat.
Yeah. Also, the cat's name is Frodo and her name is Sam. It's Sam, yeah. And Frodo. Like, please.
I did feel like there were a couple of missed opportunities on the cat front. Like, purring is something a cat does that makes noise. And in this universe, you would think that that would potentially be a big threat. And they didn't really play that up, and meowing too. Like, I was kind of thinking, because the cat was silent basically for the entire movie, I was like, oh my God, is this movie going to end with the cat finally meowing once? And like, it's going to be like this oh shit moment where it cuts to black, as like the implication being that the aliens are finally going to come get this cat or something. But they never did that. So I don't know. It was just like, man, this is it's a really great cat. I mean, I loved all the cat acting, and BJ, you talked with the director about how he you know, how all of that came to be. But yeah, I was just kind of like, I was like, oh man, in a movie that is all about sound, for an animal to not make any noise in this whole thing, that's kind of a, I don't know, I just thought it was maybe like a little bit of a missed opportunity there. But okay, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to talk to you guys about before. Oh, Chris, you mentioned your audience was clapping throughout. Was the moment you were talking about, like when Joseph Quinn's character has the cat and he's like running and jumps off the dock, the pier at the end? Is that what
you're
talking
exactly
about?
Yeah, exactly that. Okay. Like, as soon as he makes it, everyone in the audience was like, yes! I was like, all right, like, this movie has these people hooked. And they clapped at the end too, the final shot, which is like a great final shot where she takes her headphones out and the Nina Simone song is playing. And it's such a great moment, because like, you could read that as like a quote unquote bad moment, because like, she's going to get killed by this monster, but it's her going out on her own terms. And it's like moment of, it's like an unhappy ending that's also a happy ending. It's such a difficult balancing act. And I can't believe it works as well as it does. Like, everything in this movie that works just has me like, there's no excuse for this movie to be as good as it is. Like, this is like a studio mandated sequel. And it's like one of the best movies of the year. I'm genuinely like kind of blown away that they pulled this off. So yeah.
I love the like ending. So like, yeah, the Joseph Quinn jumping off the pier, so kick-ass, so awesome, like gets your heart pumping, so happy to see him you know, make it to the boat. That's great. But the ending of Sam, like, one, in clothing that is not like her I need comfort, I'm dying clothing, listening to a song she loves, taking the headphones out and dying while she is still feeling good and not like withering away to cancer. Mm-hmm. Hell yes. Like, hell yes. That is exactly how you go out. That is so perfect. It's going to be quick. It's going to, you know, be over before you know it, but she doesn't have to just like wither away. This is like a hot take. I am very much like pro dying with dignity, and I think that it is like super inhumane that people don't get to make those choices in most parts of this country. So getting to see her make that choice, I was like, yes, yes, you do this, because I think I would have really rejected this movie if it would have ended with him like, you know, laying her down after she passes away and sadly taking the cat and jumping in the, like, I would have hated that. So the fact that this is how it ends, like, nailed it.
I was genuinely expecting like a cop-out ending where like they even like he convinces her to go with him or something like that.
And yes,
the fact that they didn't do that is like, it's so like smart, and it's a better movie because of it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Totally. And also, like, I loved that Jaimin Hansu's character, who is a big part of the second movie, is kind of like barely in this movie. And like the trailer kind of implies that he's going to be a much bigger part. And I love that the movie has the courage to not lean on him as a piece of connective tissue. It's kind of like he's like a maybe slightly larger than normal Easter egg or something, but you don't really need to know anything about that and what happens later on. I just thought it was like a really smart, I was happy to see that choice made, where it didn't feel like, okay, now we're going to explain this whole colony that pops up later on in the second movie or any of that stuff. It's just like the very, very early stages of that. It was like the best case scenario for what can happen in a, like you said, a studio mandated prequel, where I feel like if this was a Disney movie, for example, that is not what would happen. Like, Disney is so obsessed with, you know, especially in like the Star Wars universe, like wink, wink, nudge, nudging you to death with all the little, you know, pieces of connective tissue and all of that stuff. And this movie just kind of like barely sees that stuff in there. And has like some restraint, basically. So I just wanted to shout that out.
It requires you to put those pieces together yourself, because we know from the second movie that he becomes, you know, the leader of the colony on the island. He even explains that because of all the commotion of getting people on the boats, there were originally 12 boats, but only 2 made it out. And so we know that information. So then when we see him and we see him, you know, in like the theater and doing all these things, and he already has this sort of like leadership position of like, he's the one who tells her, you know, shut the hell up, like, mm-hmm. don't say anything, cover your cough. Like, we can see, oh, yes, he is like a natural leader. He has always been a leader. He was somebody who acted fast the day that it all happened. And the fact that they're one of the boats that got out, like, we can put those pieces together and go, we know why the boat got out, because he's a leader, because we've seen him be a leader. We don't need this new movie to remind us of that. We already know this information. And I love a sequel that expects us to just remember things from before instead of hashing it out for us. Like, it's not dumbing it down. And everything is so dumb these days that it just makes me so happy when it's not.
Yes, you can say that again. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with BJ's interview.
Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust custom 5-in-1 spray paint lets you choose from 5 spray patterns with a twist of the dial. It protects indoor and outdoor metal and wood projects for long-lasting results, and is available in more than 40 colors. Get started on your painting project at Menards, number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers, according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
All right, the only thing to note before we get into the interview is that at one point, BJ does mention something that happens in Stranger Things Season 4. So if you're still not caught up on that show and don't want to know anything heading in, I guess catch up on that before you listen to this. But otherwise, there's some great stuff in this interview. Especially, I love that you asked him about that weird egg scene, which I thought, I was like, oh no, is this going to be the part where the movie like grinds to a halt and starts explaining its mythology and all of that, but it's really just like a quick thing, and it doesn't really get bogged down in that at all. But I was very interested in what his answer was there. So here is BJ's conversation with writer-director Michael Sarnowski.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I had a really, the premiere was last night. It was a blast. Yeah, I'm good. How are you doing?
Oh, doing well. My first question is not a question. It's more of a, how dare you? Because I was a sobbing mess at the Grove last night because of this movie. So I just want to know, where can I bill my therapy bill to you?
Paramount, yeah. Okay, Paramount's cool. Going to take care of all that. This is a legally binding statement.
Fantastic. Incredible.
Just kidding. That's not true.
So you were tasked with writing a prequel to an already extremely popular franchise, and that, I think, can be kind of an overwhelming ask for any creative. And I think, you know, there's probably this instinct for a lot of people of, okay, well, here's an origin story about these big armed baddie aliens. And instead you took a very human approach. So I'm curious to know what your creative process was like even approaching this movie.
Yeah, I mean, so initially John Krasinski came to me, he had seen my last movie, Pig, and he really liked it. And he kind of said, you know, what would it look like if you brought sort of the Pig touch to the Quiet Place universe? And he gave me a lot of space to kind of figure out what that would would mean to me. And yeah, I think for me, that meant finding a character that was sort of on an unexpected emotional journey and really focusing on that as the core of the film. And the kind of apocalypse monster stuff is there, but it's kind of happening around that core emotional story. And also, like, I think the, you know, especially if you go back to the first film, it's a very like unique family drama about guilt and forgiveness. And, you know, it's at its core, I think what makes it great is that it's this beautiful character study. So I think sort of doing justice to that tradition in the franchise while finding a very different character story to focus on was what excited me. And that was, I think that just like sort of paired nicely with this world. I think there's something about these Quiet Place films where you're leaning in so much and so breathless because of the suspense that you're then able to do these kind of quiet character explorations. And sort of without realizing it, you're leaning in, and instead of jumping, you're crying. And that was like fun to play with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on a personal note, when I was 23, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and given a 5% chance to live.
Wow.
This past March was my 10 year. And so I'm still here. We love defying statistics.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. But this is all to say that the decision to have, you know, Lupita's character be somebody who is already living the end of the world when the literal end of the world happens, I thought was just very brilliant. So I would love to know how you really tapped into this character and this very specific feeling of having already accepted the end of the world, because as evident by the puddle that's, you know, some worker had to mop up at the end of my screening, you nailed it.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I think, you know, I think the idea of someone who already was dying appealed to me because you can't go with any of the classic horror movie tropes then. Like, if survival isn't even really the end game, you know, the whole like fight the monsters, escape the city, like all of that stuff just kind of goes out the window. So I almost kind of wanted to kneecap myself a little bit that way, where it's like, okay, if we can't do any of the easy stuff, like let's really dive into this thing and let's find our meaning in this story through Sam. And I don't know, I just loved the idea of when suddenly like the outward world becomes what she's been dealing with for her recent life. How does that sort of give her an opportunity to find kind of new life and to find new connection and form like a different relationship with her own death? And you know, focusing on kind of like the small moments and the small surprising connections felt very natural in that. And that kind of like lent itself well to this Quiet Place world. And that all just sort of unfolded really nicely. And yeah, and then it just became about like making sure every scene, even the big ones, were kind of about being focused on Sam's perspective and what she's going through and what she wants. And I think, you know, I give credit to the audience that like, people can it was a risk, but like people can sit down and like experience this. They can experience and put value into this and understand sort of a less conventional narrative and a less conventional character and still like really sort of see the beauty and meaning in what she's going through. And they're willing to kind of go there with her, which has been really nice. And yeah, I just kind of fell in love with Sam and just really wanted to kind of see the end of the world through her eyes.
I love the choice to make it less of a story of survival and more of a story of dying on your own terms, especially in America. I think we have a really warped perspective with our own mortality and our own relationships with death. So this was so, so refreshing to watch.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. So I know that you are a Milwaukee boy. I grew up on the like border of Illinois and Wisconsin. So
oh, yeah.
I think you can probably understand when I say that for a lot of people who grow up in the Midwest, a city like New York is this idealized world that a lot of us learn about through movies. And yet in watching this, the person next to me who is a New Yorker was like, God, this movie makes me really miss New York. So How do you approach having the city, which becomes a character itself, feel so lived in when it's not a place that like you are fully lived in?
Yeah, no, I mean, step one was research. I mean, when I first got the job, I rented an apartment in New York for a month and I just wandered around a lot. I read a lot of books about New York. I Just tried to kind of like steep myself in it. And then the other thing I just tried to lean into was that, like, I think, you know, even from the Midwest, we all kind of have, somehow we have our own relationship with this city of New York. Like, it has this kind of like cultural significance. And a lot of it, I think, has been through sort of like tragedy and things like 9/11, but like New York sort of means something to everyone. And I think kind of leaning into this idea of like exploring characters that New York means something slightly different to all of them. Like Sam, this was her home, and this was something she had to kind of like leave behind when she became ill. And then she's seeing it again for the first time in a while. For Eric, he's an immigrant who came to New York kind of expecting things and expecting connection and maybe not finding it. And like, I think, you know, I think we all kind of put a lot of weight onto what New York City is. And it's almost like, I mean, for me, the movie was almost less about what those specific meanings are and more the fact that we put those meanings onto this city and then what watching this meaning kind of crumble around us does to us. So, you know, it's just kind of it is just like a very ripe setting to explore sort of facing the reality of the world falling apart.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad that you brought up, you know, the connections we all have, because the second that we see Sam covered in the dust, I was immediately transported back to sixth grade watching the footage of 9/11 all over again. So it was very surreal to, like, you know, immediately be thrust back into that headspace. So on a lighter note, though, was it a coincidence that both Pig and A Quiet Place Day One both have food as such driving forces and heart to the plot? Or is that just your thing? And should we expect more of these types of stories moving forward?
I mean, as a Midwestern boy, I love some good food. I think it's related to also why I love having animals in movies. I think there's something that I just find so relatable about when you point a camera at an animal, or when you point a camera at an actor eating food. Like, on a certain level, you know that you can't be lying. Like, the audience knows, like, that's an animal and they're going to do what animals do. And, you know, we never used like a CG cat in this movie for that reason, that you always kind of want to feel like there's a reality to that that can't be faked. And it's the same with like watching people eat. Like, there's something that, remember, even as a kid, I think it was in like the Ocean's 11 movie, when you're watching Brad Pitt just like eat tons of food the whole time, and you're just like, what is this feel like? There's just something like you can't, that's just real. He's just eating a hamburger. Like you're always kind of, you know, you're always trying to like sell reality in movies, but something about food and animals, you just like don't second guess it, because it's like, yeah, there's something so fundamental about that.
Totally. And I mean, bless the evil algorithms that are coming for us all. But the second I got out of the movie and opened Instagram, it was like, you might want to follow Schnitzel the cat. And I'm like, damn right I do. So I would love to hear about cat directing. Like, I don't think people really think about what goes into having animals in a movie, especially one where there's so many things for this cat to jump around on to get distracted by. But like, the same way that we wanted to give awards to the dog last year from Anatomy of a Fall, like, I feel like these cats deserve some awards because incredible animal acting.
They were amazing. Like? I mean, it's sort of like there's no such thing as cat directing. It's about like, what, Mr. Cat, what are you willing to give us today? Like, you kind of, you know, you surround yourself with incredibly talented animal trainers and these beautifully trained cats. And then you just kind of have to like figure it out with them on the day a little bit of like, you know, they're never like, sometimes they just nail exactly what you want. Sometimes it's like, oh, they don't want to do this thing. Like, this is too, there's too many distractions. We have to simplify, or we have to like choose another direction. So it's, you know, it's kind of a fun discovery every day. And as you make the movie, as you go along, you kind of get to know a little bit more of like, oh, this is how the cat will respond in this situation. Like, let's tailor the scene this way a little bit so that we can really capture something authentic with the cat. So it's a lot of kind of give and take and just feeling out the animals, and then just having extremely talented trainers who get incredible stuff out of these cats.
Wonderful. And so I also want to talk a little bit about the character of Eric, played by Joseph Quinn, who I think this is such a beautiful performance for him, especially for anybody who is, you know, still mourning Eddie in Stranger Things. I think this is going to be a very nice piece for them to have and hold on to. But you have Lupita and as Sam, who is so determined, knows exactly where she's going, you know, has already kind of mourned the world. And then you have Eric, who is this very scared puppy, essentially, like following her around. I mean, he's a human, but this is sad animal tracking. So what was it like having to navigate both of those dynamics between these two characters, especially at the start, where those dynamics are much farther apart than the end when they become quite close?
Yeah, I mean, I think in, I mean, step one is kind of the script phase where you kind of imagine how that progression is going to work. But then when it really kind of is realized is when Lupita and Joe start kind of navigating each other and hearing each other out. And a lot of this movie is like the two of them gradually seeing each other. And there's a lot of shots of them just kind of like processing each other and learning to kind of empathize. And so, I mean, a lot of that is just sort of on the performance. But, you know, for me, that core kind of, I like that idea of, you know, Sam, it's like Eric almost invades her story. Like he, even the way he kind of comes into the movie is a little bit like, what? Like, you, like, this is my movie. Like, what are you doing in my movie? Like, I'm on my journey. I've decided what I'm going to do. Leave me alone. Like, and then Eric sort of is in this phase of like, he's so traumatized and confused that Sam sort of becomes this campfire in the darkness for him, and he puts like too much emphasis on her and too much focus on like needing her, and she's kind of like, I can't be your campfire, like I didn't sign up to like mean anything to anyone at this point in my life. And I think it's kind of about like both of them finding a little bit of a middle ground where like Eric can't, you can't put that kind of focus on someone else, that kind of pressure on someone else to like be your campfire. You have to sort of find that in your own soul. And then she also realizes that like, even though, you know, she thought she kind of knew how she was going to round things out, like she had to sort of see someone else more fully for the first time in a while. And I think that kind of allowed her to connect with her own humanity and her own history. So yeah, I mean, it was just sort of something that, you know, you hope for in the writing, and you come up with these ideas that you think could resonate, and then you have incredible actors just kind of realize it.
Yeah, they both are just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, I think we all know that the Academy fails to recognize the brilliance in genre film, especially acting, but they both are two of the best performances I've seen this year.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely killed it. And so with Eric, I mean, we know what happens to many of the people on the boat because of A Quiet Place Part Two. Is there any interest in pursuing what happens with Eric moving forward, or are you happy with where his story has ended?
I mean, I definitely approached this story as a contained, you could watch this without having seen any of the other Quiet Place movies, without ever seeing any other one, and you can appreciate this for what it is. I mean, I definitely think that there is a strong possibility that he could be on that island, and he could be in the later films. And you know, I haven't had any chats about that yet, and there's nothing official, but like I think, you know, there's a lot of characters in this universe that are really wonderful and fun to explore. And you know, I'm sure they'll come up with some very cool ways to bring them back.
Amazing. So looking, towards the actual monster side, because we've talked a lot about the very human side, something that I was really struck by is that shot of the globe with like sticky notes on it. Is there anything that I should be looking out for when I go and see this again, or when this is on Blu-ray and I go frame by frame like a psycho? Is there anything on that globe, or was that, just beautiful set dressing?
I mean, we were definitely pretty specific about it. I think I don't think we're trying to like seed anything totally, but like it's like, oh, wait for Quiet Place Denver. Like that's not really what we were going for. But I mean, we were definitely kind of trying to communicate that, you know, this, and it's alluded to in the second Quiet Place. They mentioned that like Shanghai had been hit. But you know, we wanted to make it clear that like there's hotspots all around the world. And I kind of like the idea that I remember looking at, you know, what are the loudest cities in the world, that logically, like, you know, creatures would kind of coalesce in a lot of these loudest cities in the world and these sort of urban centers. And so, you know, I think you see there are probably things like what's happening in New York happening all around the world. But no, there's nothing like, you know, not like a crazy, I mean, it's, you know, I think hopefully it'll, for whoever does the next Quiet Place movie, it'll be the same thing that John's stuff was for me, which was I studied those first two Quiet Place movies and tried to look at all the little details and nuances and figure out which things I wanted to borrow and expand upon. So yeah, if someone sees it and decides they want to do, you know, Quiet Place Rio, then they can have at it.
Oh, definitely. I always think about one of my favorite movies as a kid was Independence Day, because it was like the craziest thing I had ever seen as a kid.
Yeah.
And you get those shots of, you know, the ships burning in different cities around the world. And I don't know, it's like it really lets your mind understand the scope of something that's happening. So The Globe did that for me in this
Oh,
movie.
that's great to hear.
Yeah. And so in talking about, you know, the things that you wanted to borrow or expand upon, did you have to, you know, talk with John Krasinski about any of like the lore expansion, or, you know, this is also kind of the most up close and personal look like we're really getting in some of these creatures. And you like, there's the weird egg thing. What's up with the weird egg feeding? What?
Yeah,
it's gross and cool, but what is it?
So, I mean, yeah, like I definitely, I mean, you know, I would suggest things in the script, and then there wasn't like some Bible of like, here's how the creatures work and you got to do this stuff. It was, you know, everyone was kind of open to new ideas. I think a big thing with these creatures was finding that balance of like, you don't want to over explain them. Part of what's so fun about them is that they're very alien, and they're not, we don't fully understand them. So I wanted to kind of like hint at a couple things. I mean, for me, the egg thing, and it's very like not made a focus. I didn't kind of want to make that scene like, hey, here's what's going on, and like that's important, because it's not important to Eric at that time. He's just trying to save Frodo, and you're just kind of getting a hint that there's like an ecosystem of these creatures around him. But yeah, for me, what I was getting at with that was, you can see all these like sort of pools of this like sort of pink, glassy liquid, and if you look closely, you can see that there's like bodies in those pools. And the idea is that, you know, in the other movies, you kind of get that the creatures take people, and they never really say like what they're doing with them. And I think everyone's just like, oh, they're like eating the people or something. But I like the idea that the creatures are kind of like leafcutter ants that are sort of like farming, using the organic material of people to grow what is their food source, which is these kind of weird melony egg mushroom things that they sort of feed the little ones with. So it just kind of is like hinting at sort of, you know, at the end of the day, these are farmers, and they have a little bit of like a family dynamic to them, which I thought, I liked that idea, especially coming off the first Quiet Place, that's about a rural farming family. So yeah, that was kind of what I was hinting at without kind of making too fine a point of it.
That's such a clever approach, because the second I got out, I was like, well, I have to go see this again when it goes in the theater, specifically because I want to hyperanalyze that scene. So now I have, you know, a little bit of jumping off point to check out. So that's absolutely perfect. So these aliens, though, are also, they're so scary. Like anything with limbs that are a little too long immediately give me the ick in ways that I don't like. So when you're coming up with the scares or these big, you know, set piece moments, where does that come along in the process for you? Because like the human stuff is so dialed in. And then this movie, though, reminds you like, oh, don't forget, there are giant aliens like that are gonna wipe you out if you don't shut up. So where do these set pieces come in? Do they come organically in the script? Or is it like, all right, we've had, you know, X amount of pages of heartfelt emotional stuff, let's blow up a building?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you want all of these moments to feel rooted in character, like perceived through the lens of character, and to be playing a role in this character's journey. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a little bit of everything. I think the things I was always thinking about, was one, how do we kind of like piece this out so that there feels like there's a build to how we're interacting with these creatures. So like at first we're dealing with shadows and little pieces, and then by the end you can have like two dozen creatures chasing our main characters, and like how we kind of like escalate that gradually was a big thing that we were always keeping in mind. I mean, one thing I think is really like powerful about these creatures is that kind of uncanny valley thing, where it's like, if you look at them in the right way for a second, you almost think it's a person. And then you're like the first time we see a creature, you see sort of this silhouette that mm-hmm. sort of just looks like a person standing up. And then suddenly like the head opens up and the arms come out, and it's like, oh, what the heck is that? And I think there's something fun to play with there. And there's a moment where like the creature, you know, first finds Reuben and like you know, its head comes into frame and it sort of just feels like this weird faceless flat thing. And then it opens up. And I think playing with kind of those, that uncanny nature of the creatures is fun. And then kind of escalating it into, you know, the like herd dynamic side of it was exciting to me. This idea that, you know, there's so many of these creatures and they are just like thundering through the city. And if there's a sound going by of like a helicopter, you're about to get a herd of 1,000 creatures running by. And yeah. I think thinking of like how all those things could sort of play out, you start sort of piecing those things together. And then the, you know, the logical extensions of them come about. Like, okay, when helicopters are coming by to deliver the order to evacuate, that's important that you hear the evacuation order, but then that also presents a threat because we've learned that when helicopters go by, there's going to be a herd of creatures and you need to hide from it. And so some of it just sort of evolves naturally in that way from the things that are like specific and interesting about the creatures. And then, yeah, you're always thinking about kind of the pace of the movie overall of like, you know, if you were just always at a 10 of intensity, it would start feeling monotonous. And if you were always in like sort of the quiet emotional space, it would start feeling monotonous. So you always have to kind of be keeping that roller coaster ride going up and down and totally. Balancing those things.
Totally. I have time for one last question for you. So if it's your end of the world, what is your Patsy's Pizza? What is the thing that you are going after because you've got to before everything comes to the end?
I mean, it wouldn't work as well for mine because you kind of need someone to be making it, but I would do sushi. I love some sushi. But like, I don't know, maybe there's an omakase chef still going at it. But yeah, I love me some sushi.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today, and congratulations on one of the best third installments of a franchise I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too.
All right. Any other closing thoughts about this movie before we wrap things up? Chris, any final thoughts here?
Boy, I'm like dreading. They're absolutely going to announce a fourth movie, and I'm really like dreading what that's going to be because this is so good. And like, is lightning going to strike twice? Like, I can't imagine. Like, this feels like a fluke. It genuinely feels like this like happened by accident. Like, I know it didn't, but it's like, this is so good. Are they really going to be able to make a fourth one as good as the end? But I guess we'll find out. I don't know. But I'm wildly impressed with this movie. And I'm really glad it's doing well because, you know, good movies deserve to be seen. Good movies deserve to find an audience. So, good. I'm really interested in seeing what Michael Sarnowski does next now because, you know, he's made two movies and two of them, he hit them out of the park both times. Like, Pig is phenomenal and this is really damn good. So I'm dying to see what he does next.
I was just looking into this and he's directing a movie about an aging Robin Hood played by Hugh Jackman.
Is he doing that one?
Yeah. And then I think Jodie Comer is like the woman who Robin Hood comes into contact with. And it's very mysterious, like what the plot is actually going to be. But that's another one where I feel like aging Robin Hood played by Hugh Jackman, that could go wrong in a billion different ways. But I think Michael Sarnowski with these two movies has proven that like we should give him the benefit of the doubt here. So, okay, BJ, any closing thoughts on A Quiet Place Day One?
I agree with Chris. They're definitely going to greenlight another movie. I'm very curious to see what direction they take. In the interview, we did talk about how they have that globe and they marked, you know, different places. And he even joked, like, it's not like we're going to start making, you know, a Quiet Place Denver and show like different cities around the country and how they responded to it. But if they do another one, I do hope that it goes international. I would love to see how a different country with like, you know, a different military response or, you know, just different culture in general with dealing with, you know, outside world, since in America, everything is like, shoot it. Just anything that is like a different cultural approach to how to deal with aliens, I think would be really, really cool. Because they're going to keep making them. So at least do something interesting with them.
Yeah, 100%. And it sounds like Sarnowski was not super interested in coming back to direct this. So like maybe take the lesson that grabbing interesting up-and-coming filmmakers is the way to go here instead of like, I don't know, getting Akiva Goldsman or like, what, you know, whoever is running the Transformers writer's room to step over to this. I would love to see like this be a proving ground for up-and-coming directors, almost like, or like different people cycling through or something, almost like the what the Mission Impossible franchise was, you know, back in the day before Christopher McQuarrie took it over, basically. So anyway, we'll see how it all plays out, but stay tuned to Slash Film for much more. You can find a lot more about A Quiet Place Day One at slashfilm.com, and linked inside the show notes for this episode, you'll find a few links there. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all on Monday.
Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big money at Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save